This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Today's show is brought to you by BarkBox.com.
For humans, BarkBox is a delivery of 4 to 6 natural treats and super fun toys curated around a surprise theme each month. For dogs, BarkBox is like the joy of a million belly scratches.
Get one free extra month of BarkBox at www.getbarkbox.com/babes. That's GETBARKBOX.com/BABES.
From Cabernet to Monet, they're here to slay the art history babes.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Corey.
And I'm Nat, and we are the art history babes.
Yeah, we're still rocking it with two of us, two babes today. Mm-hmm. We were just talking about some feminism in contemporary television.
Yes, which I've been very, like, hyper aware of lately. I'm a Game of Thrones watcher, so we're talking about, and I won't give too much away, but last week's episode, actually, well, as we're recording this, so it'll be a ways back by the time you guys hear it. But
it's a recent episode, what, late July episode?
Yeah. Where there's a scene of Khaleesi in a room with all these leaders of different countries and regions, and she's trying to kind of convince them to join forces with her and try and take down King's Landing, aka Cersei, who is another female in charge of a huge region of land in the world, the Seven Kingdoms, essentially, which, whatever. If you're a fan, you know that that's not exactly how it's going down right now, but it's a huge role. And it's only been controlled by male characters until this point, so kind of a big deal. She's in charge
of
it now.
Nice twist.
Yes, and the person who she's most worried about is another female who is in charge of lots of countries and is trying to coax these other people into joining her who are also women. Like, it's a table.
Women.
It's this round table of women talking about if they're going to, you know, join and fight against this huge kind of superpower, essentially. And there's this great, you know, after the episode scene where one of the producers talks about how the scene would not be the same with men, that it would be pretty boring because you've seen it so many times and time again.
Definitely.
It's people just talking about whether or not they should go to war and how they should do it if they do. And that's not interesting inherently. It's not something that's, you know, it happens. It's a scene you kind of glaze over and you pay attention again when the battle starts. But the fact that it's these really powerful, opinionated, intelligent women, it really makes the scene dynamic and, like, you really focus in on it. And it's unbelievable.
It's
not unbelievable. It should be more...
should be believable.
Yeah, exactly. It's believable, so it should be more common.
So I, like, recently, I don't watch Game of Thrones, and to be completely honest, I have zero intention of watching Game of Thrones. It's just not my bag. Like, it's just not my thing. I watched one episode once, and I was like, nah, this just isn't for me. No hate on anyone who is into it, but I did somehow end up in a conversation about feminism in Game of Thrones recently with, like, really close friends of mine, and I was, like, doing my best to try and, like, understand and follow the argument, not being someone who watches it. And a really good friend of mine got into this argument with someone else who I didn't really know him very well about Cersei and, like,
oh yeah.
And the other dude was, he just was like hating on her like crazy, which I understand she's like an evil character.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
I understand she does a lot of really shitty stuff. So like fairly, he was like hating on her. And then my friend was like trying to make this argument about how she's actually like a very feminist character though, because in a lot of ways she's doing the same thing a lot of male characters have been doing for a long time. And I just found as a lover of all things feminism, I was like really entranced by this conversation and this debate that was going on, especially because I didn't, like, I don't watch the show. And I was just like trying to follow it. And it was really interesting because I actually got another friend involved who is a woman and a feminist. And she was like, she's not a fan of Cersei, but she was also trying to see this like feminist angle that my guy friend was making about it. And it turned into this really interesting like mix of different opinions about whether like Cersei's redeemable or not. And like my guy friend who was making the argument for her, like Cersei's his favorite character. And
understandably so. She's not necessarily my favorite, but I do get that argument. And I actually, we talked about it on our Eurobabes episode, but I was in Croatia after our Art History Babes Euro escapades. I went off on my own with some other friends, and we did a Game of Thrones walking tour in Dubrovnik, because if you
are
oh, it's gorgeous. And if you're a big Game of Thrones fan, you know that most of the outdoor scenes in, like, King's Landing and other locations as well, because, you know, CGI, they're filmed in Dubrovnik. So we could kind of walk through and see all these places. The tour guide, who was just lovely, he was an extra, and he had a lot of insider information about the show and whatnot. And he was kind of talking about Cersei, and like he had been in scenes with her and stuff. And Lena, what's her last name? Lena, shoot, I will look it up. But she's a badass. Just
the person who plays
her.
Is that who it is?
Okay. Yeah. I'm wanting to say Lena Dunham, knowing that's not right. It's Lena something.
I really like imagining Lena Dunham in Game of Thrones.
That would be a great SNL skit.
Yeah, it really would.
But she is just super cool, as I've heard. And yeah, he talks about how she is this character who's so awful and so ruthless, but you do empathize her more than you empathize with any other character who's done equally as horrible things. Mm-hmm. Because the thing about Cersei is she's a mother, and she's a woman. So she, kind of touching on what Corey couldn't from watching the from not watching the show, she has this human quality because she cares about her children in such an extreme way. And everything about her is so quote-unquote masculine in that she would do anything and hurt anyone to get where she wants to be and to take care of the only thing that she cares about, which is her children.
That's like, very Slytherin.
Yeah.
Very Slytherin of her.
Yeah. And if you're watching the show, you know where that gets her and everything. But it is. It's something that you look at some of the male characters who have done anything and said anything to the point where you truly hate them. Like, you can't watch those actors in any other show without feeling just this immense sense of disdain. That is a real thing, but that will never happen with Cersei because she does have this human quality of motherhood that none of these male characters can ever
That's very interesting.
Have. Yeah, it is. It's I don't know. I love Game of Thrones, I gotta say. I it took me a few seasons to get into it, but once I was in, I'm all in.
I mean, there are things from what I can tell. I understand why people are into it. I think for me, well, one, I really, really struggle with just violence. So like
that's, oh, I do too. And I look away all the time and I cringe all the time, so I get that.
Yeah, that's already a problem for me. And two, like, let's be real, I watch way too much TV as it is. I don't need to get into anything else. So it's just a combination of like me just choosing my what media I consume.
Yeah.
Not in any way saying that like it seems like a really cool world and like a very interesting thing, and I like all of, at least as a bystander, it's almost kind of fun for me to not actually know what's happening in the show, but to be a part of, like, conversations about it sometimes.
Like, I could see reading a book about the show in, like, 10 years. Like, never watching it, but, like, then
I do that.
Watching a documentary about it and reading about it.
I would read, like, a social commentary on Game of Thrones. That sounds
dope. That's Corey's angle. And then going back to this idea of the violence, I think that's a perfect segue into our episode.
Yeah!
Because I'm with Corey. Violence makes me super uncomfortable, and as I'm very aware of watching UFC fights with my boyfriend last night and today that it does make me super uncomfortable, but I also try and like stay aware of the fact that it's such a real part of human nature, yeah. And to completely ignore it and shut yourself off from it is not
the correct approach. It makes it worse a lot of the time. Because, like, to be fair, like, I grew up in a situation where I didn't have, like, I could watch anything I wanted, and I watched, like, horror movies from a very young age and stuff, and so, like, I grew up with it, like, around me a lot, and the funny thing is, like, as I've gotten older, I've become more sensitive to it, and it's, like...
Because you realize that even the stuff that's quote-unquote fake is so rooted in things that are scarily real.
Real, exactly! So, like, I've become more sensitive to it, and, like, I'll be completely real, the more I think about it, the more, like, my sensitivity just gets more and more intense, which is fine, it's just part of who I am, but, like, I also can't live in a utopia where violence doesn't happen, so yeah, you have to, like...
Exactly.
You have to, like, you know, try and strike that balance, but also, before we jump in this episode, that is an important point to make. We're going to do... Nat brought up UFC fighting. We're very soon, like probably right after this episode comes out, we're going to drop an episode in anticipation for the big like Mayweather-McGregor fight, which has been also a very interesting thing to watch from a distance as someone who's not into boxing or UFC or anything. So like we're going to do an episode kind of about one, the spectacle of violence, and also portrayals of boxing in art throughout history, because there's a lot of really cool ones.
And the artistry of fighting, because you can't deny going back to, like the Greeks and stuff. There is this spectacle, but there's also an element of athleticism and kind of beauty and like grace in a way.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
It's complicated.
So that's probably going to be like a pretty intense episode, but I'm really excited for that one. So be on the lookout for that. That'll come out probably right before the fight, so like sometime in August. But yeah, so today we're doing the last installment of our thesis series. It's Nat's turn. She's going to dive in to some of the main ideas from her thesis and focus on, well, she was one of us that focused solely on one artist. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be talking a lot about him today and his work, which is super intense, but also like really cool.
Yeah.
So Nat, take it away.
Yes. I agree with all of the things said just now. Gottfried Hollenwein is an Austrian-born artist, and the reason that I brought him up in tandem with this idea of violence is that it's definitely a heavy theme in his work. It's something that is really weaved into everything that he does, and not because he has some sort of appreciation or draw like
weird
towards
attraction
violence.
He's
not trying to fetishize violence, which I think could be a common misconception looking at his art, so I want to say that right off the bat. Like I said, Austrian-born in 1948 Vienna, so if you are interested in history or just, you know, a human being that knows what's happened in the last 100 years, you know that it's a very unique and kind of horrible place to come into. This is post-World War II Austria, and his life is, in his outlook, I should say, not his life, his outlook is really shaped by this time and place in history. So the aftermath of World War II comes into his work pretty much in every way from my point of view, or not from my point of view, but as I would say it, it's in everything that he does, but I'm going to focus in this episode on his work that directly references World War II. It is important to say that, 1948, he was born, so he is not someone who lived through World War II. He does not have any, quote-unquote, direct connection to it. It's really the aftermath and this idea of the second generation following the war that he falls under the umbrella. It's underrepresented, I think, at this state in time.
Like World War, like art based
post World War II, okay, as like a separate generation.
Okay, yeah.
Does that make sense? Yeah, because I think people are just now getting comfortable talking about World War II casually, and like
that's something that like I've been thinking about a lot recently, actually, is like I feel like that's fairly recent, and it obviously the more and more removed we get, the better it is, but like the, like, obviously our willingness to just talk about World War II is like so different from like our grandparents'.
It's something
willingness.
We take for granted.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. Because from my personal experience, the second I learned about the Holocaust and World War II, it was something that could be talked about just freely and in conversation. And that's my perspective as someone born in 1993 in California, in the United States. So that's very different than what he's coming from. You know, he came from this culture of silence, essentially, where people were so uncomfortable talking about what had happened, mostly because of their close contact to it. Austria was obviously, you know, implicated in what happened in mostly Germany and Poland. And so there's this complicated dynamic of, are they victims? Are they perpetrators? Like, where do they fall into this huge, gross situation, and people just don't really want to deal with it.
Yeah.
And so this is his perspective, and like we were talking about, people are more comfortable talking about what had happened or what has happened now. And so in a way, him being born after World War II, he kind of knew more about what had happened than his parents' generation. And I know that's a weird way of putting it, because living through something is such a different experience than hearing about it. Mm-hmm. But the people who lived through it had this kind of weird, some of them truly didn't understand the gravity of what was happening at the time that they were living.
I feel like that is a great way to describe any heavy life experience. Yeah. Like, you look back afterwards and you're like, fuck.
You can look at it more objectively.
Yeah,
versus,
but when you're in it, any life experience, not that I have lived through anything even remotely close to World War II, like, privileged as fuck, but, like, any heavy life experience, it's, like, when you're in it, I think your survival instincts are so intense that it's just about getting through it.
Yeah.
And then, the years later, when you can actually, like, look back at it, it's, like, this whole new lens. Like,
exactly.
This whole new experience of, like, holy shit, like, that happened, you know?
Yes, totally. And on top of that, just the way that things were kept from public knowledge during World War II. So it's a combination of, people who lived through it who just couldn't quite digest, or they couldn't process what was happening because they were living it. So that was going on, and at the same time, people were just in the dark about a lot of things that were going on, especially in Austria, because there wasn't as much going on directly there. So it's super complicated. But as he grew up, it was not something that was openly talked about, but he sensed that something was not quite right in his home city.
Something's not right about
this. Yeah, you know, he had good instincts, and he's written a lot, had done a lot of interviews about this kind of unique Austrian experience, but I will read for you guys a quote, one of my favorites. He says, "Vienna, the city I was born into right after the Second World War, was a dreary place. The long shadows of the Third Reich were still cast over the city, and the smell of death was in the air. I remember the empty streets, ruins of bombed houses, rust, rubble, no colors, no sound. There was a sense of despair. All of the grown-ups I saw seemed silent, dark, and broken. I never saw anybody laugh. I never heard anybody sing. It was a world that stood still, as if undecided yet if life should go on. What I didn't know then was that my parents' generation had recently lost two world wars in a row and just completed the biggest genocide in history."
That's crazy.
Yeah. So it's heavy. We'll just start there. His artwork deals with very heavy themes. It's not for the faint of heart, but I would really encourage.
He was born into heaviness.
Exactly.
Like, his entire upbringing as like a small child was just like weighted down by
right?
like, this crazy thing.
Exactly. So that's where we're starting out. And
so this ain't cotton candy stuff we're talking about here.
It is not. As one of my professors said to me when I was talking thesis at one point, she was like, "You seem so nice and happy, though." It's like, okay, these are not, like, mutually exclusive things.
To be fair, as smart as she is, she's kind of a cotton candy person. So,
like, yeah, like, not me, this person we're talking
about. I feel like at least her academic interests are nothing like this. Like, nothing this heavy at all.
Not at all. So, he deals a lot with empathy, with dealing, empathy for victims in general. So, a lot of his work, it includes children, like paintings of children. And I should include, I think every work that I'm going to talk about is done, they're all paintings or printed works done in these hyper-realistic styles. So, there's that weird mix of, like, looking at something and feeling, like, especially connected to it because it looks so, quote-unquote, real. And that is definitely a factor. And I should mention that this style is not, it's not based on wanting to get a rise out of people just to get a rise out of people. He considers himself a conceptual artist. So for him, this style of work draws the biggest reaction, but he wants that reaction because he thinks that it's so important. What he's saying is something that really should resonate with people and he wants people to sit and dwell on. So it's not about the spectacle. It's not about upsetting people for the sake of being able to do it. There's intention there. And yeah, so he considers himself a conceptual artist. It's really important to note looking at his work. And I'm going to very, very briefly brush the surface of what he does. So if you go and look at him on your own, just keep this in mind. And there's a really great article by critic Peter Gorson, and it's called Die Unterrich. My German is okay. It's not great. But it deals a lot with this idea of the conceptual artist, and he talks about him in relation to Joseph Beuys and Andy Warhol and, like, how his work kind of, like, follows their legacies, and it's super interesting. And we're going to take a quick break, but when we get back, I will get into some of his paintings.
Hey, Nat, did you know that the FDA doesn't require tampon companies to disclose a list of the ingredients in their tampons?
That's pretty horrifying.
Yeah, so major brands use synthetic ingredients and harsh chemical cleansing agents, whereas Lola is 100% cotton and BPA-free.
And for those of you who are a little more environmentally conscious and don't even want to use the applicator, they make applicator lists, they make various sizes, and panty liners for those who want them. And yeah, you can customize your subscription so you can get exactly what you need, you know, in the right sizes.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And it gets delivered directly to your door, so you don't have to worry about, like,
lazy girl's dream.
Exactly. You don't have to worry about running off to the store because they will be there every month at your door. Also, $5 off your first box.
Come on, guys. Can't beat that.
Pretty exciting. Head on over to trymylola.com/babes. That's B-A-B-E-S. And start your subscription today.
Go, guys. Do it.
And we're back!
Guys, I made her do that.
Do you guys, like, do you remember the skit with Jimmy Fallon, Saturday Night Live, back in his, like, youthful days, and he was a radio DJ, and he was, like, absolutely ridiculous, but he always, like, opened with, like, and we're back! And then he would do, like, all the stupid, like, radio DJ, like, tropes. Anyway, it's really good. You should probably Google it.
Google it, guys.
Do it.
And back to Helenvine. So, one of... God, I gotta say, I love his stuff, but I always feel weird being one of my favorites, because they are pretty gruesome.
Yeah.
But
they're not something that, like, brings you joy.
They're not, but they're important. Yes, so we talk about them.
They're intense and important.
So one of his most important works is a 1979 watercolor, and it's titled Lebenwerts und Lebens, and that's in German. Oh, gosh. My German, guys. It's titled Lebens und Werts Leben, which means life unworthy of life. Which is a heavy name. We'll just start there.
Yeah.
Life unworthy of life.
Just ruminate on those words for, like, a minute.
Exactly. His titles are not chosen without thought. So the painting is of a child who appears to be about a toddler. And she is face down in a plate of food. And a little backstory. So, 1979, Helen Vine reads a story about Austrian forensic scientist Dr. Heinrich Gross, who was in charge of the euthanization of countless children and adults, but children for this story's purpose, during World War II. And when asked about this euthanization of children, he commented that it was done humanely because they just put poison in the food. They mixed it into the food, and the children passed away peacefully upon eating it. And, you know,
they're not fucking dogs.
Yeah, like, and you need to do that to a dog. Humans. Is hard.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
I don't know if you guys have ever had to put down a dog, but, like, that's hard.
Exactly.
Think about doing that to thousands and thousands of children.
Humanely.
Exactly.
Off.
So, and this is, I mean, this is post-war. He is, like, coming out saying this stuff. Well, if that's not enough, you know, why is Helen Vine, you know, up in arms about this in 1979, 2 decades after the war is over? What's going on? So, Dr. Gross was about to become Austria's new head of psychiatry. The country's new head of psychiatry. Literally, that was what was happening. This is the article that he read that got him so upset. And people didn't respond, and that got him more upset. So he read it, was outraged, looked around, saw that no one else was outraged, and was trying to figure out why that was. And so what he did is painted this photograph of a child literally dead in a plate of food. It's pretty gruesome.
It is. It's rough.
It's not
an enjoyable image. Like, kind of, trigger warning, if you go to look at these images, they're not fun to look at.
Yes. Like, They deal with very real and upsetting circumstances around World War II. But I will say, in this episode, what I discussed, this is the most graphic. Yeah, so he painted this. He wrote into a magazine Profil that he had worked with in the past and asked them if they would publish it with an open letter to Gross. And they said yes, and this was the letter. He says, "Dear Dr. Gross, when I was watching Holocaust, the TV program, I thought again about your attitude as reported in the Courier. And since this is the year of the child, I want to take the opportunity to thank you on behalf of the children who were taken to heaven under your care. I want to thank you that they were not, quote, injected to death, end quote, as you have called it, but simply died by having poison mixed into their meals. With German greetings, yours, Gottfried Helnbein." So hopefully you picked up on the heavy amount of sarcasm in that. He just wanted to, like, emphasize how ridiculous this notion is, and then how even more ridiculous it is that people could think that this man should be put in charge of the head of psychiatry.
I'm sorry, someone who could do that is not of a healthy mental state.
Yes.
Like, I don't know anything about this person, but if you can enact that kind of, like, horror and feel okay about it, like, you're
and
not...
And justify it after
yeah,
the fact, too.
You're not of a healthy mental state, and you definitely don't deserve to be in charge of other people's mental health. Like,
not
it's
all.
So messed up.
And so, just to give you an idea of, you know, a nice lesson, I guess, about human nature, yeah, people didn't really respond when the TV program, the articles about him were... When they came out, people didn't respond. But when this painting and letter came out in the magazine, people were rightfully very upset. And it was something it was the nature of seeing it, I think, that people underestimate how visual we are as human beings. And this extremely visual, graphic depiction of what you're reading or hearing about really hits you in a way that language can't. And I don't know.
Definitely.
I don't know how to say it better than that. But it does. And it did. And this was a really pivotal moment for his career because he realized the weight that images have. I mean, I think he already knew. He obviously had an idea of it going into making this, but actually doing it and seeing the response propelled him in his career and gave him kind of a sense of purpose, which pops up again and again throughout his different series. And it's a theme that he doesn't quite let go of. He really wants to prove the power of imagery and show that it can be something used to talk about important issues, not just frivolous things. Art doesn't have to be something that's frivolous. It can be something that makes you reflect on things you wouldn't necessarily want to, but you should.
And it doesn't always have to be beautiful.
And it doesn't. And it, the weird part about his art, which I'll probably talk about when I talk about each of these works, is there is this kind of dialectic of his work is extremely beautiful just aesthetically because he is skilled in, I mean, his color palettes I really like. He uses a lot of cool tones. This one especially, he uses really cool tones for the child's face, which, again, emphasizes the fact that he's dead, in contrast with warmer tones for the food, and it just, it's so striking. And he uses beauty to bring to light something that is so inherently grotesque, and it's something about the combination of the two things that make it so impactful.
Definitely.
It draws you in a way, and then it just kind of, like, hits you in the face with the reality of what you're looking at, which I just
appreciate. I'm sure you'll get into this when you talk more about the specific works, but, like, a lot, like, while some of his works are very graphic, like, a lot of them, I think, do that very thing in a lot more subtle of a way.
Yeah.
Like, it's like you're clearly looking at something intense. It doesn't necessarily make you feel good, but it's like a more subtle beauty slash intensity kind of thing going on. Whereas that work you were just talking about is pretty obviously just like, okay, let's fucking look at the reality of the situation, which can be, like, really hard but is important. But, yeah, a lot of his work, I think, is a lot more subtle than that particular painting.
No, that's a great way to bring it up, or great way to say it. And I think that has a lot to do with when he's dealing with specifics, he sometimes lets himself get into, like, something a little get into a darker territory, and he will be more specific in his painting, but only to match the specificity of what he's trying to respond to. So in this one, obviously, he's trying to depict an actual event, and he's doing it abstractly because, you know, it's not like he's working from a photograph of a child who grows poisoned. That it's something he actually never does. He doesn't use references or, like, direct references from the Holocaust. He purposefully doesn't use them. I think it's a combination of not wanting to sensationalize it and then also thinking that they're so often used just, like, historically and in education and whatnot that he thinks that they're almost, I'm trying to think of the right word. People become jaded to these images. You see piles of corpses in paintings, or not in paintings, sorry, you see piles of corpses in photographs of the Holocaust and in documentaries, and you know it's horrible, but you see it so many times that your brain can't quite comprehend
it in the same way. You become kind of desensitized.
Yeah, you do, exactly. You become desensitized to what you're actually looking at. So he purposefully avoids using those, and that is a great segue into the next work I will talk about. It deals with Reich Kristallnacht, which is The Night of Broken Glass, November 9th, 1938. It was a huge turning point in World War II. That is when, gosh, thousands of Jewish homes and synagogues and businesses were destroyed after the assassination of a politician, You know the story, but it was a big turning point.
If you don't know the story, what is it, Night by Eli Wiesel? That's a really good book about it. So check that out.
Very sad book, but you should read it because it deals with all of these same things. Just because the Holocaust and World War II were horrible does not mean you should not educate yourself. It's,
in fact, the fact that they were horrible means that it's more important that you look into it. Like,
exactly.
We all understand that this is not the easiest stuff to talk about or think about. It's not particularly fun, but, like, that makes it all the more important. So
it does.
Please don't just, like, shut off because this isn't, like a party.
Yeah, we're not trying to upset or traumatize anyone. We're talking about it because these are things that you should be able to recognize so that they do not happen again. Because exactly. There's that famous quote that history repeats itself, and we really want to try not to repeat these things because they were so bad. Like, I swear to you, I am not just like a glutton for sadness and like gore. I really don't like this stuff at all. I can't get over the importance of it.
Yeah, that's the thing, is like, that's what makes it good research and important research, though, is because it's just fucking important. So, like, let's just deal with it, you know?
Yeah, so this work, it's called Selection, or Ninth November Night. It goes by a few names. It's an installation. It was actually installed in many cities after the first time, but the first time that he created it was to mark the 50th anniversary of Kristallnacht. So, again, he sees this opportunity to really strike up a conversation and get people just thinking critically about something associated with World War II and the Holocaust that, you know, may not become a topic of conversation otherwise. He's really kind of seizing the opportunity. So, in this work, he chose 12 children at random and printed them on these enormous canvases and hung them outside the Cologne Cathedral. It's actually, I think it's across from the Cologne Cathedral and along the train station. So a lot of foot traffic there, as you can imagine. And these children were chosen at random by him, and the title Selection, which was also printed on a canvas of the same size at the beginning of the installation, is meant to emphasize the randomness of these selections. So these are not children who were alive and or implicated in the Holocaust, but he's using them symbolically to represent how easily something like this can happen and how arbitrary it is. Does that make sense?
Yes, that definitely makes sense.
Okay.
So they're not actual images of people in the Holocaust, but they're images of people, which makes them just as important as the images of people that were lost to the Holocaust.
Like, yeah.
Because they're fucking people / children. So I think that's an incredibly, like, powerful statement to make, because it's like, even though the faces of the people that you're looking at this large scale weren't people that died in the Holocaust, like, you could just as easily pull up images of small children that died in the Holocaust, and they mean just as much, you know? So I think the idea is, it's very profound, and it
goes back to the conceptual nature of his work.
That exactly.
That
goes back to our experience that we had at the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin. There's a moment, like, it's right after you move through this timeline of World War II / just, like, the Holocaust. And at the end of the timeline, and this was, to me, where the emotions really started overflowing in this particular exhibit, is, like, you get through the timeline, and then at the end, there's just four images of four completely unrelated people. There's a child, like an older man, there's an older woman, like, there's four completely unrelated people that all died in the Holocaust, and they're, like, if you read the little tags, it just says a few random facts about their life and, like, their name and stuff, and it's, like, they're these huge scale images of people that were killed because of this stupid random ass reason. And it, like, that moment for me, like, the tears started flowing, because it's a very, you have to stand there and look in the eyes of this, like, human. And so I feel like with Helmbein, he's doing the same thing, even though they're not people that died in the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. He's making you approach that idea and, like, think about it, you know?
Totally. And of this work, Simon Wiesenthal, who was a writer and Holocaust survivor, said, "Whoever still had illusions after Reichskristallnacht as to what designs the National Socialists had on the Jewish people failed to recognize the evil driving force which had manifested itself at that time. Not even the children were spared. They, too, fell victim to the destruction." So, yeah, like, that's what Helmbein's trying to emphasize, is this point in history was where people could stop saying, oh,
yeah,
they're not so bad.
Yeah.
They're not targeting the Jewish people. Like, whatever fantasies people had built to protect their...
Protect themselves. Yeah,
yeah, it was from entirely understanding what was going on.
A desire to protect yourself
that, like, couldn't really be done anymore. So at that point, either you had to choose a side, and Helmwein is just really trying to emphasize that. And okay, so this is the kicker to this installation. A few days after it was installed, the works were vandalized, and people had come and slashed the throats of the children at night, and mm-hmm. they're very graphic, like, and again, it's paper, they're not slashed, there's nothing bloody or gory about it, but just even the symbolism of seeing these young children with their throats cut, it shows you that in the same way that Wiesenthal is trying to emphasize that you couldn't shut a blind eye to what was happening after Reich Kristallnacht, 50 years later, Helmwein puts up this painting. You assume 50 years later that people know that what happened that night is bad and that we should all agree that it was a horrible,
yeah.
tragic, tragic night. Yet people are coming to vandalize this installation to memorialize it. So there are still people out there, we're assuming neo-Nazis. They never figured out who exactly did it, but you don't need to know who it was to feel the weight of that act. Like, what they're saying is evident that,
yeah,
that they disagree with trying to
humanize the situation. Like, yeah, it's, I mean, in so many ways that act, like, adds such another layer to the work.
It does.
Though. Like, it's very, I mean, it's horrible, but it's important that it happened because I think it just, like, helps prove the point further, you know?
And as I said, it was an installation that moved around to multiple locations after this, and Gottfried, or I shouldn't call him by his first name. I don't know you. I'm sorry, sir. Helmwein
my boy Gottfried.
My boy Gottfried. Helmwein decided to leave them in this state rather than replace them for that exact reason. He thought that they were much more impactful with these cuts than they were without. So some of them were, like, taped up so that they weren't just, like, flopping everywhere, but he left the cut marks, and it's impactful. He made the right call. Attaboy. all right, so my last painting that I'm going to talk about today, and I keep saying painting, we had a watercolor, we had these works that were photographs and painting, so he photographs, paints on top, and then he printed these ones on Scanachrome prints for the installation purpose, but this last one is one of his mixed media, which comes to be his, like, most famous medium, printing a photograph, oftentimes digitally modified photographs, and then painting over the top. So if you see them in person, they're enormous and they're breathtaking because they're photorealistic, but the entire canvas is covered in paint. Like, in, when I say paint, like, I mean, like, very detailed brush strokes. So from afar, they look like printed photographs. From up close, you can see, like, I kid you not, the hairs on people's faces. So it adds to everything that I love about his work. Tangent done. Moving on to this last painting titled The Adoration of the Magi. And it is the first in his Epiphany series. And this one is a figural piece, multi-figural, which is not always how he works. He does a lot of portraits. And monochromatic, black and white. It has this weird sense of, like, it looks like a Hollywood movie still in a way,
yeah,
but definitely. It also, it's evoking, as the title suggests, biblical scenes of the adoration of the Magi. So when the three kings come to see baby Jesus in the manger with Mary, da-da-da. So in this painting we have the symbolic Mary character, who is a very Aryan-looking woman, very stereotypically European, beautiful. I don't know how else to describe her. There's really nothing remarkable about her.
There really isn't. She's just hella white and, like, she's pretty.
Exactly.
And, like, that's really what it is.
Exactly. And she's wearing this really interesting outfit, which is, like, the best way I can describe it is, like, a what someone would wear to a toga party. like, it's not historically accurate, yeah. like, Grecian, but it's not.
It's kind of, like, got that toga-y feel, but it's turned into a little bit more contemporary of a dress, like, kind of a thing.
Which goes along with the entire theme of the painting, because everyone, if you, the closer you look, everyone does look costumey.
Yeah.
Her outfit looks costumey, and she is surrounded on her left by four guards, SS guards, and on her right by another. And they are all wearing uniforms that, at first glance, you assume they're, like, legit uniforms, but they're kind of all blurred and distorted and, like, a little bit off to the point that they are kind of costumey. They're not, they're not entirely accurate.
I mean, the whole scene's fairly theatrical. Like, they all have got theatrical looks on their face. Like, they look like they're in, it's a still of a play,
basically. Yeah, and it's super somber. And on her lap is a little baby, and he's standing in this contrapposto pose, which is super kind of cute and strange. So he's got, like, his one leg up on his mom's thigh, and he's the only person in the entire scene who's looking directly at the viewer. So he's looking out at the viewer. He's completely naked. He kind of looks smug, which is a weird way to describe a baby, but he does look a little smug. And, I look at this painting in two completely, you can look at it in two separate ways, or that's how I see it. I'm sure you could look at it in a thousand ways, in theory. But one way to look at it is that this baby is meant to symbolize a baby Jesus and Mary, obviously. And if Jesus were to be born in the time and place in history that this is depicting, aka the Reich, during World War II, then the SS officers would be scrutinizing him for things like, does he look Aryan? Does he look Jewish? Does he have any qualities that would be especially redeemable or not? Like, there's just all of these.
It's also important to just, like, just throw out there that Jesus was not in any way Aryan.
Exactly. Like,
historically speaking, he was definitely...
Well, king of the Jews.
Yeah, he was brown skin-toned, dark-featured, like, born all around.
Yeah,
he was not Aryan at all.
So that's one way to look at it, is just... And in that storyline, it's interesting because Helmbein was not a huge advocate of the Catholic Church. He had a lot of issues with it just growing up as a Catholic, as often happens for people who grow up in any sort of religious institution. They kind of have, like, you know, negative experience or negative, emotions toward it happens a lot.
I think it's very common. It's not everyone's situation, but it's very common to be someone who is brought up in a certain religion, and then you kind of reform yourself out of it. You kind of maybe start to question things, and things obviously get a lot more complicated.
And especially for him, a lot of this came out of, he went to Catholic school as a child and would see a lot of paintings of, like, martyred saints, and that's where he saw a lot of the gore growing up, honestly.
Dude, which is, for real, like, let's be real, we've talked about it a few times before, but, like, Catholicism is not chill. Like,
it can get very dark.
And in some ways it's really interesting, but, like, I don't know, I went to Catholic school too, and you grow up from a very young age, you're, like, looking, you're not just looking at, but you're adoring an image of someone being crucified.
Yeah.
How intense is that? Like, yeah. So, like, religion can be a very intense experience.
It's messy.
Yeah, it's so a messy thing. It's a messy thing.
So in one way, he's kind of posing these two opposite but equal evil forces in his eyes, like the Catholic Church. And a lot of his disdain also comes from learning about the Catholic Church's relationship to the Holocaust and, like, you know, notions of, like, the church possibly being aware of what was happening to a degree and not intervening and things like that. There's all sorts of complications, and I'm not going to get into it, but that's where he's coming from. So that's his view on the Catholic Church. So there's those ideas, you know, the Nazis and the Catholic Church as these villains of such, and kind of pitting them against each other in this painting. The other way to look at it is that baby being a baby Hitler. And the idea of these soldiers looking at him in a way that's, yes, adoring in a way, but also very skeptical. None of these soldiers look particularly, like, stoked. They all look like they know what's going to happen in a way. Like, I describe the painting as a somber. Like, they all look wary. So that's another idea, is it's trying to kind of paint a depiction of the blindness with which people followed Hitler and the Nazis into this situation, and also, like, representing the people who weren't blind, who, like, kind of saw it happening, but also didn't have the guts to do anything about it.
Definitely.
So it's just all around this really intense moment.
In a weird way, this work and just the situation you're talking about, I think speaks to people's, like, indifference to their own beliefs, you know what I mean? It speaks to people's desire, and I think this is a very human desire, people's desire to let someone else tell them what to do.
Yes.
And I think that's, like, kind of the indifference that's happening in this painting. It's, like, these guards, who are clearly older and much more experienced than this tiny baby, like, kind of potentially maybe following the orders of this baby once he gets older. And I think that just speaks to the commonality of that situation. Like, we're not gonna get super contemporary political here, but it's definitely fucking relevant. So, like, take that as you wish. But, like, there's, I think, a really common desire to just let someone else lead and to follow.
Especially when you're afraid or things are just, they seem to be crazy around you.
Yeah.
And you don't know what's the right decision, so you would rather have someone else make it for you.
Exactly.
So, yes. Yeah, this, he's dealing with a lot of these themes, and there are so many of his paintings that I could talk about forever, but I'm going to stop there.
It was pretty solid. We dealt with a lot of intense things. I did have one question for you before we bounce off. Did you, like, watch any, like, interviews with him, or have you seen a lot of, like, personal? So, like, what's his demeanor, like, temperament? Like, what's he just like in a very, like, just, like, how's he act? Because obviously he's dealing with really intense stuff, but, like, I'm just curious what his, what his personality is like.
So I don't know how to answer this exactly, but I'll give a few examples or anecdotes that I think might help. So he wears sunglasses, like, all the time.
At night.
And indoors. Yeah. So I actually, I met someone recently who helped put up his show at the Crocker Art Museum in Sacramento, and I kind of had that moment of being like, what's he like? Did you meet him? Did you talk to him? Like, nerding out a little. And he, at first, he was like, yeah, he was fine. And then he came back to me a few minutes later and was like, yeah, he wore his sunglasses all the time. And I just, that's what struck me about him. Like, I don't know what else to say.
Hey, that's a cool move. Like,
well, and so,
like, that's a dope move.
He's good friends with Marilyn Manson. He actually was at Marilyn's.
That's my favorite thing you've told me about him.
He has painted multiple portraits of Marilyn Manson. He was at Marilyn Manson and Dita Von Teese's wedding, and, like, was had a heavy hand in the wedding. He lives in a castle in Ireland.
Oh, yeah, that's dope,
yeah,
too.
There's an article about him and his family, and it's called it's something about, like, the modern day Adams family they compare them to.
That's all cool. I've ever wanted to be.
Yeah, like, and he considers himself closer. He relates more to rock stars and rock and roll and, like, comics than he does fine arts. So, kind of jumping back to Corey's episode on the arts and crafts movement in this, like, hierarchy of, like, crafts and fine art, like, his work definitely falls into the category of fine art, but if you were to ask him what he's into, he appreciates, quote-unquote, like, low arts more than other fine arts. Like, he's inspired just as much by Karl Barks, who's the guy who invented Donald Duck, as he is by, like, fucking Joseph Beuys. Like, he has this really cool open mind about what he thinks art is.
That's what's up.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So that's the
if
best.
If you want to come on our show, just like
he's done costume design for theater. He's a super, super interesting artist. He's all over the place. He's done covers for Rolling Stone. He did portraits of Mick Jagger. He's just a cool
Mick
guy.
Jagger.
Yeah.
Also, like, you could have just been like, he lives in a castle, and that would have answered my question.
Or he's friends with Marilyn Manson.
Yeah. Just, like, all of those are great little things.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for that, Natalie. I think that was a very fascinating approach to... it's probably, like, we do these profiles on individual artists, but obviously since you did your thesis research on him, that was a very intense profile of an individual artist. So that was really cool. I enjoyed that. Let's do some quick listener mail. Listener mail from Michelle. Subject, extra links and Fabergé eggs. Good morning. I found your podcast after it was recommended on History Chicks. Once again, aww, I think we mentioned this before, but shout out to History Chicks. They are also two dope chicks who talk about history. So if you like what we do and you like history, you should probably follow them. Let's see. I've fallen in love already. I'm wondering if you could send a link to, quote, Brooke's website or Instagram, as I'd love to go check out what y'all were ooing and eyeing about. I would also like to put in a request vote for a high-quality, maybe canvas, art history babes bag. Anyways, thanks so much for helping, or for keeping me entertained this morning. I look forward to many more mornings with you all. So, Brooke is a listener who also wrote in, and we just, like, went nuts about her stuff on the Fabergé eggs episode. She recently sent us a link to her new website. She has got a website up with all of her work. So we will, I don't know if it's on our Fabergé egg sources now, but I will add it to it. I think we've also tweeted about it, but I'll add that to that. If you're interested, go check out her artwork. It's really fun. Also,
we're working on the bags. We're working on merchandise. So
merch is happening.
It's in the works.
Give us a minute. Just give us a minute. But, like, we're working on merch right now. I think within the next month, we'll have merch out and happening.
Yeah, so other merch ideas would be great. Right now, we're thinking, just the classics, like t-shirts, canvas bags,
maybe
stickers.
Maybe some mugs.
Yeah,
you
mugs
know?
Would be cute. Tell us what you guys would like.
Yeah.
And send us cute slogans. Like, quote us.
Yeah, we want to do, like... I mean, we'll obviously do just, like, some general art history babes, like, shirts and bags and stuff, but we'd like to do, like, specific quotes and, like, more specialized stuff. And like I said, we're in the works with, like, a t-shirt, screen printer and stuff. So if you have something that, like, you think would make a really great art history babes, like, t-shirt or whatever, email it to us. But also, all of y'all who are interested, definitely stay tuned, because I think probably by September we want to get some merch going of some sort.
Definitely.
So be on the lookout for that. But thank you so much, Michelle, for the message. If you have any thoughts or ideas or anything you want to share with us, email us at arthistorybabes@gmail.com. You can also help us out by writing a review on iTunes, which we love. Our Patreon is patreon.com/arthistorybabes. We're on every single social media, so find us and, you know, follow us and all that jazz. We really appreciate all your support, and let us know if you have any thoughts on this episode, or, like, we talked about some, like, really heavy ideas, so we'd really like to hear your feedback and stuff.
Especially for this stuff, like, it sounds weird, but I love getting feedback, because I do... It's hard to dwell in, like, such intense topics.
Oh, definitely.
And as someone so outside of it to talk about it, sometimes I feel like an intruder. So the times that I've had people come up to me and almost, like, they're not saying it to reassure me, but telling me how it affected them or how they appreciated it or how it connects to something that they care deeply about, whether they're Jewish or have family members who lived through the Holocaust, all these things, it really... I don't know. I really appreciate it, and I love hearing it, and...
I think that's a fair, like, that could be applied to our entire thesis series.
Totally.
Because if you're in academia, you know that imposter syndrome is a very real thing, and we spend insane amounts of hours and time in doing this research, and no matter, no matter what the research is, that you can't help but have moments of being like, who am I to talk mm-hmm. about this shit? So, like, if any of the stuff we talked about in our thesis series, which was really fun for all of us to do, it was really fun to get to share our research with you in some capacity. If anything in this series stuck out to you, or you think it's interesting, or you'd like to know more, or you have questions yeah. or thoughts.
We have very thorough bibliographies.
Yeah, we have so much to talk to you about.
If you even just want a copy of our bibliographies at these interest you, we can hook you up.
Yeah, so we have so much to talk about. We have so many ideas on all of this stuff because we really put a lot of time and effort into all of it. So anything that sticks out to you, please email us about it. We can also do follow-up blog posts about ideas and things like that. So thank you so much for listening about our research that we've given part of our soul to.
And now seen part of our souls.
Yeah, now you understand us a little bit deeper. But we'll be getting back to kind of normal episodes. Be on the lookout for that boxing episode. That one I think is going to be really fun. But yeah, thank you so much for listening.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. From Cabernet to Monet, they're here to slay the art history babes. Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.